Why? Epiphyte Corp's business plan is about an inch thick. Neither fat nor skinny as these things go. The interior pages are slickly and groovily desktop published out of Abby's laptop. The covers are rugged hand-laid paper of rice chaff, bamboo tailings, free-range hemp, and crystalline glacial meltwater, made by wizened artisans operating out of a mist-shrouded temple hewn from living volcanic rock on some island known only to aerobically gifted spandex-sheathed left-coast travel bores. An impressionistic map of the South China Sea has been dashed across these covers by molecularly reconstructed Ming Dynasty calligraphers using brushes of combed unicorn mane dipped into ink made of grinding down charcoal slabs fashioned by blind stylite monks from hand-charred fragments of the True Cross. The actual content of the business plan hews to a logical structure straight out of the Principia Mathematica. Lesser entrepreneurs purchase business plan writing software. Packages of boilerplate text and spreadsheets, craftily linked together so that you need only go through and fill in a few blanks. Avi and Beryl have written enough business plans between the two of them that they can smash them out from brute memory. Avi's business plans tend to go something like this. Mission. At name of company, it is our conviction that, to do the stuff we want to do, and to increase shareholder value are not merely complementary activities, they are inextricably linked. Purpose. To increase shareholder value by doing stuff. Extremely serious warning. Printed on a separate page, in red letters on a yellow background. Unless you are as smart as Johann Carl Friedrich Gauss, savvy as a half-blind Calcutta bootblack, tough as General William Tecumseh Sherman, rich as the Queen of England, emotionally resilient as a Red Sox fan, and as generally able to take care of yourself as the average nuclear missile submarine commander, you should never have been allowed near this document. Please dispose of it as you would any piece of high-level radioactive waste and then arrange with a qualified surgeon to amputate your arms at the elbows and gouge your eyes from their sockets. This warning is necessary because once, 100 years ago, a little old lady in Kentucky put $100 into a dry goods company, which went belly up and only returned her $99. Ever since then, the government has been on our asses. If you ignore this warning, read on at your peril. You are dead certain to lose everything you've got and live out your final decades beating back waves of termites in a Mississippi Delta leper colony. Still reading? Great. Now that we've scared off the lightweights, let's get down to business. Executive summary. We will raise some money, then do some stuff, and increase shareholder value. Want details? Read on. Introduction. This trend, which everyone knows about, and that trend, which is so incredibly arcane that you probably didn't know about it until just now, and this other trend over here, which might seem at first blush to be completely unrelated, when all taken together, lead us to the proprietary, secret, heavily patented, trademarked, and NDA'd insight that we could increase shareholder value by doing stuff. We will need dollars, a large number. And after, not too long, we will be able to realize an increase in value to dollars, an even larger number, unless hell freezes over in midsummer. Details. Phase 1. After taking vows of celibacy and abstinence and foregoing all of our material possessions for homespun robes, we, namely appended resumes, will move into a modest complex of scavenged refrigerator boxes in the central Gobi Desert, where real estate is so cheap that we are actually being paid to occupy it, thereby enhancing shareholder value even before we have actually done anything. On a daily ration consisting of a handful of uncooked rice and a ladleful of water, we will begin to do stuff. Phase 2, 3, 4, up to and including N-1, we will do more stuff, steadily enhancing shareholder value in the process. Unless the Earth is struck by an asteroid 1,000 miles in diameter, in which case certain assumptions will have to be readjusted. Refer to spreadsheets 397 through 413. Phase N. Before the ink on our Nobel Prize certificates is dry, we will confiscate the property of our competitors, including anyone foolish enough to have invested in their pathetic companies. We will sell all of these people into slavery. All proceeds will be redistributed among our shareholders, who will hardly notice, since spreadsheet 265 demonstrates that by this time, the company will be larger than the British Empire at its zenith. Spreadsheets. Pages and pages of numbers in tiny print, conveniently summarized by graphs that all seemed to be exponential curves screaming heavenward, albeit with enough pseudo-random noise in them to lend plausibility. Resumes. Just recall the opening reel of The Magnificent Seven, and you won't have to bother with this part. You should crawl to us on hands and knees and beg us for the privilege of paying our salaries. To Randy and the others, the business plan functions as Torah, master calendar, motivational text, philosophical treatise. It is a dynamic living document. Its spreadsheets are palimpsests, linked to the company's bank accounts and financial records, so that they automatically adjust whenever money flows in or out. Beryl handles that stuff. Abby handles the words, the underlying abstract plan, and the concrete details that inform those spreadsheets, interpreting the numbers. Abby's part of the plan mutates, too, from week to week as he gets new input from articles in the Asian Wall Street Journal, conversations with government officials in fly-blown Shenzhen karaoke bars, remote sensing data pouring in from satellites, and obscure technical journals analyzing the latest advances in optical fiber technology. Abby's brain also digests the ideas of Randy and the other members of the group and incorporates them into the plan. Every quarter, they take a snapshot of the business plan in its current state, trowel some Maybelline onto it, and ship out new copies to investors. Plan number 5 is about to be mailed simultaneous with the company's first anniversary. An early draft has been sent to each of them a couple of weeks ago in an encrypted email message, which Randy hadn't bothered to read, assuming he knew its contents. But little cues that he's picked up in the last few days tell him that he'd better find out what the damn thing actually says. He fires up his laptop, plugs it into a telephone jack, opens up his communication software, and dials a number in California. This last turns out to be easy because this is a modern hotel and Kinakuta has a modern phone system. If it hadn't been easy, it probably would have been impossible. In a small, stuffy, perpetually dark, hot plastic-scented wiring closet, in a cubicled office suite leased by Novus Ordo Seclorum Systems Incorporated, sandwiched between an escrow company and a discount travel agent in the most banal imaginable disco-era office building in Los Altos, California, a modem wakes up and spews noise down a wire. The noise eventually travels under the Pacific as a pattern of scintillations in a filament of glass so transparent that if the ocean itself were made out of the same stuff, you'd be able to see Hawaii from California. Eventually, the information reaches Randy's computer, which spews noise back. The modem in Los Altos is one of half a dozen that are all connected to the back of the same computer, an entirely typical-looking tower PC of a generic brand, which has been running, night and day, for about 8 months now. They turned its monitor off about 7 months ago because it was just wasting electricity. Then John Cantrell, who is on the board of Novus Ordo Seclorum System, Inc., and made arrangements to put it in the company's closet, borrowed the monitor because one of the coders who was working on the latest upgrade of Ordo needed a second screen. Later, Randy disconnected the keyboard and mouse because without a monitor, only bad information could be fed into the system. Now, it is just a faintly hissing off-white obelisk with no human interface other than a cyclopean green LED staring out over a dark landscape of empty pizza boxes. But there is a thick coaxial cable connecting it to the internet. Randy's computer talks to it for a few moments, negotiating the terms of a point-to-point protocol, or PPP, connection, and then Randy's little laptop is part of the internet, too. He can send data to Los Altos, and the lonely computer there, which is named Tombstone, will route it in the general direction of any of several tens of millions of other internet machines. Tombstone, or tombstone.epiphyte.com, as it is known to the internet, has an inglorious existence as a mail drop and a cache for files. It does nothing that 1,000 online services couldn't do for them more easily and cheaply. But Avi, with his genius for imagining the most horrific conceivable worst-case scenarios, demanded that they have their own machine, and that Randy and the others go through its kernel code one line at a time to verify that there were no security holes. In every bookstore window in the Bay Area, piled in heaps, were thousands of copies of 3 different books about how a famous cracker had established total control over a couple of well-known online services. Consequently, Epiphyte Corp. could not possibly use such an online service for its secret files, while with a straight face, saying that it was exerting due diligence on its shareholders' behalf. Thus, tombstone.epiphyte.com. Randy logs on and checks his mail. 47 messages, including one that came 2 days ago from Avi. Avi@epiphyte.com. That is labeled Epiphyte Biz Plan, .5.4.ordo. Epiphyte Business Plan, 5th edition, 4th draft, in a file format that can only be read by Novus Ordo Seclorum, which is wholly owned by the company of the same name, but whose hard parts were written, as it happens, by John Cantrell. He tells the computer to begin downloading that file. It's going to take a while. In the meantime, he scrolls through the list of other messages, checking the names of their senders, subject headings, and sizes, trying to figure out, first of all, how many of these can simply be thrown away unread. Two messages jump out because they are from an address that ends with AOL.com, the cyberspace neighborhood of parents and children, but never of students, hackers, or people who actually work in high tech. Both of these are from Randy's lawyer, who is trying to get Randy's financial affairs disentangled from Charlene's with as little rancor as possible. Randy feels his blood pressure spiking, millions of capillaries in the brain bulging ominously. But they are very short files, and the subject headings seem innocuous, so he calms down and decides not to worry about them now. Five messages originate from computers with extremely familiar names, systems that are part of the campus computer network he used to run. The messages come from system administrators who took over the reins when Randy left, guys who long ago asked him all the easy questions, such as, "What's the best place to order pizza?" and "Where did you hide the staples?" and have now gotten to the point of emailing him chunks of arcane code that he wrote years ago with questions like, "Was this an error, or something incredibly clever I haven't figured out yet?" Randy declines to answer those questions just now. There are about a dozen messages from friends, some of them just passing along net humor that he's already seen 100 times. Another dozen from other members of Epiphyte Corp., mostly concerning the details of their itineraries as they all converge on Kinakuta for tomorrow's meeting. That leaves a dozen or so other messages, which belong in a special category that did not exist until a week ago, when a new issue of Turing magazine came out, containing an article about the Kinakuta Data Haven project, and a cover photo of Randy on a boat in the Philippines. Turing is such a visual magazine that it cannot be viewed without the protection of welding goggles, and so they insisted on a picture. A photographer was dispatched to the crypt, which was found visually wanting. A tizzy ensued. The photographer was diverted to Manila Bay, where he captured Randy standing on a boat deck next to a big reel of orange cable, a volcano rising from the smog in the background. The magazine won't even be on newsstands for another month, but the article is on the web as of a week ago, where it instantly became a subject of discussion on the Secret Admirers mailing list, which is where all of the cool guys like John Cantrell hang out to discuss the very latest hashing algorithms and pseudo-random number generators. Because Randy happened to be in the picture, they have mistakenly fastened upon him as being more of a prime mover than he really is. This has spawned a new category of messages in Randy's mailbox: unsolicited advice and criticism from crypto freaks worldwide. At the moment, there are 14 such messages in his inbox, 8 of them from a person or persons identifying himself or themselves as Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. It would be tempting to ignore these, but the problem is that a solid majority of people on the Secret Admirers mailing list are about 10 times as smart as Randy. You can check the list anytime you want and find a mathematics professor in Russia slugging it out with another mathematics professor in India, kilobyte for kilobyte, over some stupefyingly arcane detail in prime number theory, while an 18-year-old tube-fed math prodigy in Cambridge jumps in every few days with an even more stupefying explanation of why they are both wrong. So when people like this send him mail, Randy tries to at least skim it. He is a little leery of the ones who identify themselves as Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, or with the number 56, which is a code meaning Yamamoto. But just because they are political verging on flaky doesn't mean they don't know their math. 2. Randy@tombstone.epiphyte.com. From 56@laundry.org. Subject: Data Haven. Do you have public key somewhere posted? I would like to exchange mail with you, but I don't want Paul Comstock to read it. My public key, if you care to respond, is Begin Ordo Public Key Block. Lines and lines of gibberish. End Ordo Public Key Block. Your concept of Data Haven is good, but has important limits. What if Philippine government shuts down your cable? Or if the good Sultan changes his mind, decides to nationalize your computers, read all the disks? What is needed is not one Data Haven, but a network of Data Havens. More robust, just like Internet is more robust than single machine. Signed, the Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, who signs his messages thus. Begin Ordo Signature Block. Lines and lines of gibberish. End Ordo Signature Block. Randy closes that one without responding. Abby doesn't want them talking to secret admirers for fear that they will later be accused of stealing someone's ideas, so the reply to all of these emails is a form letter that Abby paid some intellectual property lawyer about $10,000 to draft. He reads another message simply because of the return address. From root@palace.eruditorum.org. On a Unix machine, root is the name of the most godlike of all users, the one who can read, erase, or edit any file, who can run any program, who can sign up new users and terminate existing ones. So receiving a message from someone who has the account name root is like getting a letter from someone who has the title president or general on his letterhead. Randy's been root on a few different systems, some of which were worth tens of millions of dollars, and professional courtesy demands he at least read this message. I read about your project. Why are you doing it? Followed by an Ordo signature block. One has to assume this is an attempt to launch some sort of philosophical debate. Arguing with anonymous strangers on the Internet is a sucker's game because they almost always turn out to be, or to be indistinguishable from, self-righteous 16-year-olds possessing infinite amounts of free time. And yet, the root address either means that this person is in charge of a large computer installation or, much more likely, has a Phoenix box on his desk at home. Even a home Phoenix user has got to be several cuts above your average Internet surfing dilettante. Randy opens up a terminal window and types, whoiseruditorum.org, and a second later gets back a block of text from the inter-NIC. Eruditorum.org, Societas Eruditorum, followed by a mailing address, a P.O. box in Leipzig, Germany. After that, a few contact numbers are listed. All of them have a Seattle area code, but the three-digit exchanges after the area code look familiar to Randy, and he recognizes them as gateways into a forwarding service, popular among the highly mobile, that will bounce your voicemail, faxes, etc., to wherever you happen to be at the moment. Avi, for example, uses it all the time. Scrolling down, Randy finds record last updated on 18 November 98. Record created on 1 March 90. The 90 jumps out. That's a prehistoric date by Internet standards. It means that Societas Eruditorum was way ahead of the game, especially for a group based in Leipzig, which was part of East Germany until about then. Domain servers in listed order. ns.sf.laundry.org, followed by the dotted quad for laundry.org, which is a packet anonymizer used by many secret admirers to render their communications untraceable. It all adds up to nothing. Yet Randy can't get away with assuming that this message came from a bored 16-year-old. He should probably make some token response, but he's afraid that it'll turn out to be a come-on for some kind of business proposition, probably some mangy high-tech company that's looking for capital. In the latest version of the business plan, there is probably some explanation of why Epiphyte 2 is building the crypt. Randy can simply cut and paste it into an email reply to root@palace.eruditorum.org. It'll be something vaporous and shareholder-pleasing and therefore kind of alienating. With any luck, it will discourage this person from pestering him anymore. Randy double-clicks on Ordo's eyeball pyramid icon, and it opens up a little text window on the screen, where he is invited to type commands. Ordo's also got a lovely graphical user interface, but Randy scorns it. No menus or buttons for him. He types, "Decrypt Epiphyte Bizplan .5.4.ordo." The computer responds, "Verify your identity. Enter the passphrase or bio to opt for biometric verification." Before Ordo will decrypt the file, it needs to have the private key, all 4,096 bits of it. The key is stored on Randy's hard disk, but the bad guys can break into hotel rooms and read the contents of hard disks, so the key itself has been encrypted. In order to decrypt it, Ordo needs the key to the key, which, in Cantrell's one concession to user-friendliness, is a passphrase, a string of words easier to remember than 4,096 binary digits. But it has to be a long phrase or else it's too easy to break. The last time Randy changed his passphrase, he was reading another World War II memoir. He types, "With hoarse shouts of banzai, the drunken Nips swarmed out of their trenches, their swords and bayonets flashing in the beams of our searchlights," and hits the return key. Ordo responds, "Incorrect passphrase. Re-enter the passphrase, or bio, to use biometric verification." Randy curses and tries it a few more times, with slight changes in punctuation. Nothing works. In desperation and out of curiosity, he tries bio, and the software responds, "Unable to locate biometric configuration file. Talk to Cantrell." Which is, of course, not a normal part of the software. Ordo does not come with biometric verification, nor do its error messages refer to John Cantrell or anyone else by name. Cantrell has apparently written a plug-in module, a little add-on, and distributed it to his friends in Epiphyte 2. "Fine," Randy says, picks up his phone and dials John Cantrell's room number. This being a brand-new modern hotel, he gets a voicemail box in which John has actually bothered to record an informative greeting. "This is John Cantrell of Novus Ordo Seclorum and Epiphyte Corporations. For those of you who have reached me using my universal phone number and consequently have no idea where I am, I'm in the Hotel Foot Mansion in the Sultanate of Kinakuta. Please consult a quality atlas. It is 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Thursday, March 21st. I'm probably down in the Bomb and Grapnel." The Bomb and Grapnel is a pirate-themed hotel bar which is not as cheesy as it sounds. It is decorated with, among other museum-grade memorabilia, several brass cannons that seem authentic. John Cantrell is seated at a corner table, looking as at home here as a man in a black cowboy hat possibly can. His laptop is open on the table next to a rum drink that has been served up in a soup tureen. A 2-foot-long straw connects it to Cantrell's mouth. He sucks and types. Watching incredulously is a cadre of tough-looking Chinese businessmen sitting at the bar. When they see Randy coming in carrying his own laptop, they buzz up. "Now there's two of them!" Cantrell looks up and grins, something he cannot do without looking fiendish. He and Randy shake hands triumphantly. Even though they've only been riding around on 747s, they feel like Stanley and Livingston. "Nice tan," Cantrell says puckishly, all but twirling his mustache. Randy's caught off guard, starts and stops talking twice, finally shakes his head in defeat. Both men laugh. "I got the tan on boats," Randy says, "not by the hotel pond. The last couple of weeks I've been putting out fires all over the place." "Nothing that'll impact shareholder value, I hope," Cantrell deadpans. Randy says, "You're looking encouragingly pale." "Everything's fine on my end," Cantrell says. "It's like I predicted. Lots of secret admirers want to work on a real data haven." Randy orders a Guinness and says, "You also predicted that a lot of those people would turn out to be squirrely and undisciplined." "Didn't hire those," Cantrell says. "And with Eb to handle the weird stuff, we've been able to roll right over a few speed bumps we've encountered." "Have you seen the crypt?" Cantrell raises an eyebrow and shoots him a flawless imitation of a paranoid glance.
"It's like that NORAD command bunker in Colorado Springs," he says.
"Yeah," Randy laughs.
"Cheyenne Mountain." "It's too big," Cantrell announces.
He knows Randy is thinking the same thing.
So Randy decides to play devil's advocate. But the Sultan does everything big. There are big paintings of him in the big airport. Cantrell shakes his head.
The Information Ministry is a serious project. The Sultan didn't just make it up. His technocrats conceived it.
I'm told Avi did a little bit of deft turkey baster work.
Whatever. But the people behind it, like Mohammed Pragasu, are all Stanford B school types, Oxford and Sorbonne graduates. It's been engineered to the doorstops by Germans. That cave is not a monument to the Sultan.
No, it's not a vanity project, Randy agrees, thinking of the chilly machine room that Tom Howard is building 1,000 feet below the cloud forest.
So there must be some rational explanation for how big it is.
Maybe it's in the business plan, ventures Randy. Cantrell shrugs. He hasn't read it either.
Well, the last one I read cover to cover was Plan 1, a year ago, admits Randy.
That was a good business plan, Cantrell says.
Cantrell alludes to the fact that Plan 1 brought them a couple of $1 million in seed money from a venture capital outfit in San Mateo called the Springboard Group. Randy changes the subject.
I forgot my passphrase. Need to do that biometric thing with you.
Yeah, it's too noisy here, Cantrell says. It works by listening to your voice, doing Fourier shit, remembering a few key numbers. We'll do it in my room later.
Feeling some need to explain why he hasn't been keeping up with his email, Randy says,
I have been totally obsessed interfacing with these AVCLA people in Manila.
Yep. How's that going?
Look, my job's pretty simple, Randy says. There's that big Nipponese cable from Taiwan down to Luzon, a router at each end. Then there's the network of short-run inter-island cables that the AVCLA people are laying in the Philippines. Each cable segment begins and ends at a router, as you know. My job is to program the routers, make sure the data will always have a clear path from Taiwan to Kinakuta.
Cantrell glances away, worried that he's about to get bored. Randy practically lunges across the table, because he knows it's not boring.
John, you are a major credit card company.
Okay.
Cantrell meets his gaze, slightly unnerved. You are storing your data in the Kinakuta data haven. You need to download 1 terabyte of crucial data. You begin the process. Your encrypted bytes are screaming up through the Philippines at 1 gigabyte per second to Taiwan, from there across to the States. Randy pauses and swigs Guinness, building the drama.
And then a ferry capsizes off Cebu.
So?
So, in the space of 10 minutes... 100,000 Filipinos all pick up their telephones simultaneously.
Cantrell actually whacks his forehead.
Oh, my God!
Now you understand. I've been configuring this network so that no matter what happens, the data continues to flow to that credit card company. Maybe at a reduced speed, but it flows.
Well, I can see how that would keep you busy.
And that's why all I'm really up to speed on is these routers. And incidentally, they're good routers, but they just don't have enough capacity to feed a crypto that size or justify it economically.
The gist of Avi and Beryl's explanation, Cantrell says, is that Epiphyte is no longer the sole carrier into the crypt.
But we're laying the cable here from Palawan. The Sultan's minions have been out drumming up business, Cantrell says. Avi and Beryl are being vague, but from comparing notes with Tom and reading tea leaves, methinks there's one, maybe two other cables coming into Kinakuta.
Wow,
Randy says. It's all he can think of.
Wow.
He drinks about half of his Guinness.
Makes sense. If they're doing it once with us, they can do it again with other carriers.
They used us as leverage to bring in others, Cantrell says.
Well, the question is then, is the cable through the Philippines still needed? Or wanted?
Yep,
Cantrell says. It is?
No, I mean, yep, that's the question, all right.
Randy considers it.
Actually, this could be good news for your phase of the operation. More pipes into the crypt means more business in the long run.
Cantrell raises his eyebrows, a little worried about Randy's feelings. Randy leans back in his chair and says,
We've had debates before about whether it makes sense for Epiphyte to be screwing around with cables and routers in the Philippines.
Cantrell says,
The business plan has always maintained that it would make economic sense to be running a cable through the Philippines even if there weren't a crypt at the end of it.
The business plan has to say the intra-Philippines network could be spun off as an independent business and still survive, Randy says, to justify our doing it. Neither one of them needs to say any more. They've been concentrating on each other pretty intensely for a while, shutting out the rest of the bar with their postures, and now, spontaneously, both of them lean back, stretch, and begin looking around. The timing's fortuitous, because Goto Furudenendo has just come in with a posse of what Randy guesses are civil engineers, healthy-looking, clean-cut Nipponese men in their 30s. Randy invites them over with a smile, then flags down their waiter and orders a few of those great big bottles of bitterly cold Nipponese beer.
"This reminds me, the secret admirers are really on my case," Randy says.
Cantrell grins, showing some affection for those crazy secret admirers.
"Smart, rabidly paranoid people are the backbone of cryptology," he says. "But they don't always understand business."
"Maybe they understand it too well," Randy says.
He is left with some residual annoyance that he came down to the bomb and grapnel party in order to answer the question posed by Root at eruditorium.org. Why are you doing it? And he still doesn't know. As a matter of fact, he knows less now than he did before.
Then the men from Goto join them, and it just happens that Eberhard Furr and Tom Howard show up at just the same time. There is a combinatorial explosion of name card exchanges and introductions. It seems like protocol demands a lot of serious social drinking. Now Randy's inadvertently challenged these guys' politeness by ordering them beer, and they have to demonstrate that they will not be bested in any such contest. Tables get pushed together and everything gets just unbelievably jovial. Eb has to order some beer for everyone, too. Pretty soon, things have degenerated into karaoke. Randy gets up and sings, "Me and You and a Dog Named Boo." It's a good choice because it's a mellow, laid-back song that doesn't demand lots of emoting. Or singing ability, for that matter. At some point, Tom Howard puts his beefy arm up on the back of Cantrell's chair, the better to shout into his ear. They're matched eutropian bracelets engraved with, "Hello, Doctor, please freeze me," as follows. Messages are glittery and conspicuous. And Randy's nervous that the Nipponese guys are going to notice this and ask questions that will be exceedingly difficult to answer. Tom is reminding Cantrell of something. For some reason, they always refer to Cantrell in this way. Some people are just made to be called by last names. Cantrell nods and shoots Randy a quick and somewhat furtive look. When Randy looks back at him, Cantrell glances down apologetically and takes to chivying his beer bottle nervously between his hands. Tom just keeps looking at Randy kind of interestedly. All of this motivated glancing finally brings Randy and Tom and Cantrell together at the farthest end of the bar from the karaoke speakers.
"So, you know Andrew Loeb," Cantrell says.
It's clear he's basically dismayed by this, and yet sort of impressed, too, as if he had just learned that Randy had once beaten a man to death with his bare hands and then just never bothered to mention it.
"It's true,"
Randy says. "As well as anyone can know a guy like that." Cantrell is paying undue diligence to the project of picking the label off of his beer bottle. And so Tom picks up the thread now.
"You were in business together?"
"Not really. Can I ask how you guys are aware of this? I mean, how do you even know that Andrew Loeb exists in the first place? Because of the digibomber thing?"
"Oh, no. It was after that. And he became a figure of note in some of the circles where Tom and I both hang out," Cantrell says.
"The only circles I can imagine that Andy be a part of would be primitive survivalists and people who believe they've been satanically ritually abused."
Randy says this mindlessly, as if his mouth is a mechanical teletype hammering out a weather forecast. It kind of hangs there.
"That helps fill in a few gaps,"
Tom finally says.
"What did you think when the FBI searched his cabin?"
Cantrell asks, his grin returned.
"I didn't know what to think," Randy says. "I remember watching the videotape on the news, the agents coming out of that shack with boxes of evidence, and thinking my name must be on papers in them, that somehow I'd get mixed up in the case as a result."
"Did the FBI ever contact you?"
Tom asks.
"No. I think that once they searched through all of his stuff, they figured out pretty quickly that he wasn't the digibomber, and crossed him off the list."
"Well, not long after that happened, Andy Loeb showed up on the net,
Cantrell says. I find that impossible to believe.
So did we. I mean, we had all received copies of his manifestos, printed on this gray recycled paper that was like the sheets of fuzz that you peel off a clothes dryer's lint trap. He used some kind of organic water-based ink that flaked off like black dandruff,
Tom says.
We used to joke about having Andy grit all over our desks,
Cantrell says.
So when this guy called Andy Loeb showed up on the Secret Admirers mailing list and the Eutropia news group posting all of these long rants, we refused to believe it was him. We thought that someone had just written really brilliant parodies of his prose style,
Tom says.
But when they kept coming day after day and he started getting into these long dialogues with people, it became obvious that it really was him.
Tom grumbles.
How did he square that with being a Luddite?
Cantrell.
He said that he'd always thought of computers as a force that alienated and atomized society.
Tom.
But as a result of being the number one digibomber suspect for a while, he'd been forcibly made aware of the internet, which changed computers by connecting them.
Oh, my God, Randy says.
And he'd been mulling over the internet while he was doing whatever Andrew Loeb does,
Tom continues.
Randy, squatting naked in icy mountain streams, strangling muskrats with his bare hands.
Tom,
and he'd realized computers could be a tool to unite society.
Randy,
I'll bet he was just the guy to unite it.
Cantrell.
Well, that's actually not far away from what he said.
Randy.
So, are you about to tell me that he became a Eutropian?
Cantrell.
Well, no. It's more like he discovered a schism in the Eutropian movement we didn't know was there and created his own splinter group.
Randy.
I think of the Eutropians as being totally hardcore individuals, pure libertarians.
Well, yeah,
Cantrell says.
But the basic premise of Eutropianism is that technology has made us post-human. The Homo sapiens plus technology is effectively a whole new species, immortal, omnipresent, because of the net, and headed towards omnipotence. Now, the first people to talk that way were libertarians,
Tom says.
But the idea has attracted all kinds of people, including Andy Loeb. He showed up one day and started yammering about hive minds. And, of course, he was flamed to a crisp by most of the Eutropians, because that concept was anathema to them,
Cantrell says.
Tom. But he kept at it, and after a while, some people started agreeing with him. Turned out there really was a pretty substantial faction within the Eutropians who didn't especially care for libertarianism, and who found the idea of a hive mind attractive.
So, now Andy's the leader of that faction?
Randy asks.
I would suppose so.
Cantrell says.
They split away and formed their own news group. We haven't heard much from them in the last 6 months or so.
So how did you become aware of a connection between Andy and me?
He still pops into the Secret Admirers news group from time to time, and there's been a lot of discussion there about the crypt lately.
Cantrell says,
when he found out that you and Abby were involved, he posted this vast rant. 20 or 30K of run-on sentences. Not very complimentary.
Well, Jesus, what's his beef? He won the case. Completely bankrupted me. You'd think he'd have something better to do than beat this dead horse,
Randy says, thumping himself on the chest.
Doesn't he have a day job?
He's some kind of a lawyer now,
Cantrell says.
Huh, figures.
He's been denouncing us,
Tom says.
Capitalist rotor, atomizing society, making the world safe for drug traffickers and third world kleptocrats.
Well, at least he got something right,
Randy says. He's delighted to have an answer, finally, to the question of why they're building the crypt. Retrograde Maneuver. Scio is a mud cemetery. Those who have already given their lives for the Emperor compete for mire space with those who intend to. Bizarre fork-tailed American planes dive out of the sun every day to murder them with terrible glowing rains of cannon fire and the mind-crushing detonations of bombs. So they sleep in open-topped graves and only come out at night. But their pits are full of reeking water that churns with hostile life, and when the sun goes down, rain beats them, carrying into their bones the deadly chill of high altitudes. Every man in the 20th Division knows that he will not leave New Guinea alive, so it remains only to choose the method of death. Surrender to be tortured, then massacred by the Australians? Put grenades to their heads? Remain where they are to be killed by the airplanes all day and all night by malaria, dysentery, scrub typhus, starvation, and hypothermia? Or walk 200 miles over mountains and flooding rivers to Madang, which is tantamount to suicide even when it is peacetime and you have food and medicine? But that is what they are ordered to do. General Adachi flies to Sayo. It is the first friendly plane they have seen in weeks, and lands on the rutted septic field that they call an airstrip, and orders the evacuation. They are to move inland in four detachments. Regiment by regiment, they bury their dead, pack up what is left of their equipment, hoard what little food is left, wait for dark, and trudge towards the mountains. The later echelons can find their path by smell, following the reek of dysentery and of the corpses dropped behind the pathfinder groups like breadcrumbs. The top commanders stay to the end, and the radio platoon stays with them. Without a powerful radio transmitter and the cryptographic paraphernalia that goes with it, a general is not a general. A division is not a division. Finally, they go off the air and begin breaking the transmitter down into the smallest pieces they can, which, unfortunately, are not all that small. A divisional radio transmitter is a powerful beast, made for lighting up the ionosphere. It has an electrical generator, transformers, and other components that cannot be made light. The men of the radio platoon, who would find it difficult to move even the weight of their own skeletons over the mountains and across the surging rivers, will carry the additional burdens of engine blocks, fuel tanks, and transformers. And the big steel trunk with all of the Army code books. These books were heavy as death when they were bone dry. Now they are sodden. To carry them out is beyond imagining. The rules dictate that they must therefore be burned. The men of the 20th Division's radio platoon are not much inclined to humor of any kind at the moment, not even the grim sardonic humor universal among soldiers. If anything in the world is capable of making them laugh at this moment, it is the concept of trying to construct a bonfire out of saturated codebooks in a swamp during a rainstorm. They might be able to burn them if they used a lot of aviation fuel, more than they actually have. Then the fire would produce a towering column of smoke that would draw P-38s as the scent of human flesh draws mosquitoes. Burning them can't be necessary. New Guinea is a howling maelstrom of decay and destruction. The only things that endure are rocks and wasps. They rip off the covers to bring home as proof that they have been destroyed, then pack the books into their trunk and bury it in the bank of an especially vindictive river. It's not a very good idea. But they have been getting bombed a lot. Even if the shrapnel misses you, the bomb's shockwave is like a stone wall moving at 700 miles an hour. Unlike a stone wall, it passes through your body, like a burst of light through a glass figurine. On its way through your flesh, it rearranges every part of you down to the mitochondrial level, disrupting every process in every cell, including whatever enables your brain to keep track of time and experience the world. A few of these detonations are enough to break the thread of consciousness into a snarl of tangled and chopped filaments. These men are not as human as they were when they left home. They cannot be expected to think clearly or to do things for good reasons. They throw mud on the trunk, not as a sane procedure for getting rid of it, but as a kind of ritual, just to demonstrate the proper respect for its load of strange information. Then they shoulder their burdens of iron and rice and begin to strain up into the mountains. Their comrades have left a trampled path that is already growing back into jungle. The mileposts are bodies, by now just stinking battlegrounds, disrupted by frenzied mobs of microbes, bugs, beasts, and birds never catalogued by scientists. Huff Duff. The Huff Duff mast is planted before they even have a roof on the new headquarters of Detachment 2702, and the Huff Duff antenna is raised before there is any electricity to run it. Waterhouse does his best to pretend as if he cares. He lets the workers know. Vast tank armadas clashing in the African desert might be dashing and romantic, But the real battle of this war, ignoring as always the Eastern Front, is the Battle of the Atlantic. We can't win the Battle of the Atlantic without sinking some U-boats, and we can't sink them until we find them, and we need a way of finding them other than the tried-and-true approach of letting our convoy steam through them and get blown to bits. That way, men, is to get this antenna in action as soon as humanly possible. Waterhouse is no actor. But when the second ice storm of the week blows through and inflicts grievous damage on the antenna, and he has to stay up all night repairing it by the light of the galvanic Lucifer, he is pretty sure that he has them hooked. The castle staff work late shifts to keep him supplied with hot tea and brandy, and the builders give him some zesty hip-hip hoorays the next morning when the patched antenna is winched back up to the top of the mast. They are all so sure that they are saving lives in the North Atlantic that they would probably lynch him if they knew the truth. This Huff-Duff story is ridiculously plausible. It is so plausible that if Waterhouse were working for the Germans, he'd be suspicious. The antenna is a highly directional model. It receives a strong signal when pointed towards the source and a weak signal otherwise. The operator waits for a U-boat to begin transmitting and then swings the antenna back and forth until it gives the maximum reading. The direction of the antenna then gives the azimuth to the source. Two or more such readings, supplied by different Huff-Duff stations, can be used to triangulate the origin of the signal. In order to keep up appearances, the station needs to be manned 24 hours a day, which almost kills Waterhouse during the first weeks of 1943. The rest of Detachment 2702 is not shown up on schedule, so it is up to Waterhouse to preserve the illusion in the meantime. Everyone within 10 miles, basically the entire civilian population of Tagum, or to put it another way, the entire Tagumian race, can see the new Huff-Duff antenna rising from the mast on the castle. They are not stupid people, and some of them, at least, must understand that the damn thing doesn't do any good if it is always pointed in the same direction. If it's not moving, it's not working. And if it's not working, then just what the hell is going on up there in the castle anyway? So Waterhouse has to move it. He lives in the chapel, sleeping, when he sleeps, in a hammock strung at a perilous altitude above the floor. Skerries are excellent jumpers, he has found. If he sleeps during the daytime, even casual observers in the town will notice that the antenna does not move. That's no good. But he can't sleep at night, when the Germans bounce their transmissions off the ionosphere between the U-boats in the North Atlantic and their bases in Bordeaux and Lorient, because a really close observer, say an insomniacal castle worker or a German spy up in the rocks with a pair of binoculars, will suspect that the immobile Huff-Duff antenna is just a cover story. So Waterhouse tries to split the difference by sleeping for a few hours around dusk and another few hours around dawn, a plan that does not go over well with his body. And when he gets up, he has absolutely nothing to look forward to besides sitting at the Huff-Duff console for 8 or 12 hours at a stretch, watching the breath come out of his mouth, twiddling the antenna, listening to nothing. He freely stipulates that he is a selfish bastard for feeling sorry for himself when other men are being blown to bits. Having gotten that out of the way, what is he going to do to stay sane? He has cut his routine down pat. Leave the antenna pointed generally westwards for a while, then swing it back and forth in diminishing arcs, pretending to zero in on a U-boat, then leave it sitting for a while and do jumping jacks to warm back up. He has ditched his uniform for raiments of warm Tagmian wool. Every once in a while, at totally unpredictable intervals, members of the castle staff will burst in on him with an urn of soup or tea service, or simply to see how he is doing and tell him what a fine chap he is. Once a day he writes down a bunch of gibberish, his purported results, and dispatches it over to the naval base. He divides his time between thinking about sex and thinking about mathematics. The former keeps intruding upon the latter. It gets worse when the stout 50-ish cook named Blanche, who has been bringing him his meals, comes down with dropsy, or ague, or gout, or colic, or some other Shakespearean ailment, and is replaced by Margaret, who is about 20 and quite fetching. Margaret really messes up his head. When it gets really intolerable, he goes to the latrine, so that the staff will not break in on him at an inopportune moment, and executes a manual override. But one thing he learned in Hawaii was that a manual override is unfortunately not the same as the real thing. The effect wears off too soon. While he's waiting for it to wear off, he gets a lot of solid math done. Alan provided him with some notes on redundancy and entropy, relating to the voice encryption work he is currently doing in New York City. Waterhouse works through that stuff and comes up with some nice lemmas, which he lamentably cannot send to Alan without violating both common sense and any number of security procedures. This done, he turns his attention to cryptology, pure and raw. He spent enough time at Bletchley Park to realize just how little of this art he really understood. The U-boats talk on the radio way too much, and everyone in the German Navy knows it. Their security experts have been nagging their brass to tighten up their security, and they finally did it by introducing the four-rotor version of the Enigma machine, which has knocked Bletchley Park on its ass for about a year. Margaret has to walk around the castle out of doors to bring Waterhouse's meals, and by the time she gets here, her cheeks have turned rosy red. The steam coming from her mouth floats around her face like a silken veil.
Stop that, Lawrence! The subject of today's lecture is the German naval four-wheel Enigma, known to them as Triton, and to the Allies as Shark. Introduced on 2 February of last year, 1942, it wasn't until the recovery of the beached German U-boat, U-559, on 30 October, that Bletchley Park got the material they needed to break the code. A couple of weeks ago, on 13 December, Bletchley Park finally busted Shark, and the internal communications of the German Navy became an open book to the Allies once more. The first thing they have learned as a result is that the Germans have broken our merchant shipping codes wide open, and that all year long they have known exactly where to find the convoys. All of this information has been provided to Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse within the last few days, via the totally secure one-time pad channel. Bletchley is telling him this stuff because it raises a question of information theory, which is his department and his problem. The question is, how quickly can we replace our busted merchant shipping codes without tipping the Germans off to the fact that we have broken Shark? Waterhouse does not have to think about this one for very long before he concludes that it is far too tricky to play games with. The only way to handle the situation is to concoct an incident of some sort that will explain to the Germans why we have totally lost faith in our own merchant shipping codes and are changing them. He writes up a message to this effect and begins to encrypt it using the one-time pad that he shares with Chatton.
Is everything quite all right?
Waterhouse stands and whirls around, heart thrashing. It is Margaret, standing there veiled in the steam of her own breath, a gray wool overcoat thrown over her maid's uniform, supporting a tray of tea and scones with gray wool mittens. The only parts of her not encased in wool are her ankles and her face. The former are well turned. Margaret is not above wearing heels. The latter has never been exposed to the direct rays of the sun and brings to mind rose petals strewn over Devonshire clotted cream.
Let me take it,
Waterhouse blurts, and lunges forward with a jerkiness born of passion blended with hypothermia. While taking the tray from her hands, he inadvertently pulls off one of her mittens, which falls to the floor.
Sorry,
he says, realizing he has never seen her hands before. She has red polish on the nails of the offended hand, which she cups over her mouth and blows on. Her large green eyes are looking at him, full of placid expectation.
Beg pardon?
Waterhouse says.
Is everything quite all right?
She repeats.
Yes, why shouldn't it be?
The antenna,
Margaret says.
It hasn't moved in over an hour.
Margaret is still breathing through her lacquered fingertips, so that Waterhouse can only see her green eyes, which now angle and twinkle mischievously. She glances towards his hammock.
Been napping on the job, have we?
Waterhouse's first impulse is to deny it and to explain the truth, which is that he was thinking about sex and crypto and forgot to move the antenna. But then he realizes that Margaret has supplied him with a better excuse.
Guilty as charged,
he says. I was up late last night.
That tea will keep you alert,
Margaret says. Then her eyes return to the hammock. She pulls her mitten back on.
What is it like?
What is what like?
Sleeping in one of those. Is it comfortable?
Very comfortable.
Can I just see what it's like?
Well, it's very difficult to get in at that height.
You manage it, though, don't you?
She says chidingly. Waterhouse feels himself blushing. Margaret walks over to the hammock and kicks off her heels. Waterhouse winces to see her bare feet on the stone floor, which has not been warm since the Barbary Corsairs burned the place down. Her toenails are also painted red.
I don't mind it,
Margaret says.
I'm a farmer's daughter. Come on, give me a leg up.
Waterhouse has completely lost whatever control he might ever have had over the situation and himself. His tongue seems to be made of erectile tissue. So he lumbers over, bends down, and makes a stirrup of his hands. She puts her foot into it and launches herself into the hammock, disappearing with a whoop and a giggle into his bulky nest of gray wool blankets. The hammock swings back and forth across the center of the chapel, like a censer dispersing a faint lavender scent. It swings once, twice. It swings 5 times, 10 times, 20. Margaret is silent and motionless. Waterhouse stands as if his feet were planted in mortar. For the first time in weeks, he does not know exactly what is going to happen next, and the loss of control leaves him stunned and helpless.
Oh, it's dreamy,
she says, dreamily. Then, finally, she shifts. Waterhouse sees her little face peeking out over the edge, shrouded in the gray cowl of a blanket.
Ooh,
she screams, and flips flat on her back again. The sudden movement puts an eccentric jiggle into the rhythmic motion of the hammock.
What's wrong?
Waterhouse says hopelessly.
I'm afraid of heights,
she exclaims.
I'm so sorry, Lawrence. I should have warned you. Is it all right if I call you Lawrence?
She sounds as if she would be terribly hurt if he said no. And how can Lawrence wound the feelings of a pretty, barefoot, acrophobic girl, helpless in a hammock?
Oh, please, by all means, he says.
But he knows perfectly well that the ball is still in his court.
Can I be of any assistance? I should be so obliged,
Margaret says.
Well, would you like to climb down onto my shoulders or something?
Waterhouse essays.
I'm really far too terrified,
she says. There is only one way out.
Well, would you take it the wrong way if I came up there to help? It would be so heroic of you,
she says.
I should be unspeakably grateful.
Well, then.
But I insist that you continue with your duties first.
Beg pardon?
Lawrence,
Margaret says.
When I get down from this hammock, I shall go to the kitchen and mop the floor, which is already quite clean enough, thank you. You, on the other hand, have important work to do. Work that might save the lives of hundreds of men on some Atlantic convoy. And I know that you have been very naughty in sleeping on the job. I refuse to allow you up here until you have made amends.
Very well, Waterhouse says. You leave me no alternative. Duty calls. He squares his shoulders, spins on his heel, and marches back to his desk. Skeddies have already made off with all of Margaret's scones, but he pours himself some tea. Then he resumes encrypting his instructions to Chatten. Only brute force approach will be safe. Put codebook on ship. Insert ship in Murmansk convoy. Wait for fog. Ram Norway. The one-time pad encryption takes a while. Lawrence can do Mod 25 arithmetic in his sleep, but doing it with an erection is a different matter.
Lawrence, what are you doing?
Margaret asks from her nest in the hammock, which, Lawrence imagines, is getting warmer and cozier by the minute. He glances surreptitiously at her discarded high heels.
Preparing my report, Lawrence says.
doesn't do me any good to make observations if I don't send them out.
Quite right,
Margaret says thoughtfully. This is an excellent time to stoke the chapel's pathetic iron stove. He puts in a few scoops of precious coal, his worksheet, and the page from the one-time pad that he has just used to do the encryption. Should warm up now, he says.
Ooh, lovely,
Margaret says.
I'm all shivery.
Lawrence recognizes this as his cue to initiate a rescue operation. About 15 seconds later, he is up there in the hammock with Margaret. To the great surprise of neither one of them, the quarters are awkward and tight. There is some flopping around, which ends with Lawrence on his back and Margaret on top of him, her thigh between his. She is shocked to discover that he has an erection. Ashamed, apparently, that she did not anticipate his need.
"You poor dear!"
she exclaims.
"Of course. How could I have been so dense? You must have been so lonely here."
She kisses his cheek, which is nice, since he is too stunned to move.
"A brave warrior deserves all the support we civilians can possibly give him,"
she says, reaching down with one hand to open his fly. Then she pulls the gray wool over her head and burrows to a new position. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is stunned by what happens next. He gazes up at the ceiling of the chapel through half-closed eyes and thanks God for having sent him what is obviously a German spy and an angel of mercy rolled into one adorable package. When it's finished, he opens his eyes again and takes a deep breath of cold Atlantic air. He is seeing everything around him with newfound clarity. Clearly, Margaret is going to do wonders for his productivity on the cryptological front, if he can only keep her coming back. Pages. It has been a long time since horses ran at the Ascot Racetrack in Brisbane. The infield's a commotion of stretched khaki. The grass has died from lack of sun and from the trampling feet of enlisted men. The field has been punctured with latrines. Mess tents have been pitched. 3 shifts a day, the residents trudge across the track, round back of the silent and empty stables. In the field where the horses used to stretch their legs, 2 dozen Quonset huts that have popped up like mushrooms. The men work in those huts, sitting before radios or typewriters or card files all day long, shirtless in the January heat. It has been just as long since whores sunned themselves on the long veranda of the house on Henry Street, and passing gentlemen on their way to and from the Ascot racetrack peered at their charms through the white railing, faltered, checked their wallets, forgot their scruples, turned on their heels, and climbed up the house's front stairs. Now the place is full of male officers and math freaks. Mostly Australians on the ground floor, mostly Americans upstairs, and a sprinkling of lucky Brits who were spirited out of Singapore before General Yamashita, the tiger of Malaya and the conqueror of that city, was able to capture them and mine their heads for crucial data. Today the old bordello has been turned upside down. Everyone with ultra-clearance is out in the garage, which thrums and roars with the sound of fans, and virtually glows with contained heat. In that garage is a rusted steel trunk, still spattered with riverbank mud, that partially obscures the Nipponese characters stenciled on its sides. Had a Nipponese spy glimpsed the trunk during its feverish passage from the port to the whorehouse's garage, he would have recognized it as belonging to the radio platoon of the 20th Division, which is currently lost in the jungles of New Guinea. The rumor, shouted over the sound of the fans, is that a digger, an Australian grunt, found it. His unit was sweeping the abandoned headquarters of the 20th Division for booby traps when his metal detector went nuts along the banks of a river. The code books are stacked inside as neatly as gold bars. They are wet and mildewed, and their front covers are all missing, but this is mint condition by the standards of wartime. Stripped to the waist and streaming with sweat, the men raised the books out one by one, like nurses lifting newborn infants from the bassinet, and carry them to tables where they slice away the rotten bindings and peel the sodden pages off the stacks one by one, hanging them from improvised clotheslines strung overhead. The stench and damp of New Guinea saturate the air as the river water trapped in those pages is lifted out by the rushing air. It all vents to the outside eventually, and half a mile downwind, pedestrians wrinkle their noses. The whorehouse's closets, still redolent of French perfume, powder, hairspray, and jism, but now packed to the ceiling with office supplies, are raided for more string. The web of clotheslines grows, new layers crisscrossing above and below the old ones, every inch of string claimed by a wet page as soon as it is stretched. Each page is a grid, a table with hiragana or katakana or kanji in one box, a group of digits or romaji in another box, and the pages all cross-referenced to other pages in a scheme only a cryptographer could love. The photographer comes in, trailed by assistants who are burdened with miles of film. All he knows is that each page must be photographed perfectly. The malarial reek practically flattens him the moment he walks in the door, but when he recovers, his eyes scan the garage. All he can see, stretching as if to infinity, are pages dripping and curling, turning white as they dry, casting their grids of information into sharp relief, like the reticules of so many bomb sites, the graven crosshairs of so many periscopes, plunging through cloud and fog to focus distinctly on the abdomens of Nipponese troop ships, pregnant with North Borneo fuel, alive with burning steam. Ram.
Sir, would you mind telling me where we are going, sir?
Lieutenant Monkberg heaves a deep, quivering sigh, his ribcage shuddering like a tin shack in a cyclone. He executes a none-too-snappy push-up. His hands are planted on the rim, and so this action extricates his head from the bowl of a toilet, or head, as it is referred to in this context, an alarmingly run-down freighter. He jerks down a strip of abrasive Euro bumwad and wipes his mouth before looking up at Sergeant Robert Shafto, who has braced himself in the hatchway. And Shafto does need some serious bracing because he is carrying close to his own weight in gear. All of it was issued to him thoughtfully pre-packed. He could have left it that way, but this is not how an Eagle Scout operates. Bobby Shafto has gone through and unpacked all of it, spread it out on the deck, examined it, and repacked it. This allowed Shafto to do some serious inferring. To be specific, he infers that the men of Detachment 2702 are expected to spend most of the next 3 weeks trying as hard as they can not to freeze to death. This will be punctuated by trying to kill a lot of well-armed sons of bitches. German, most likely.
Norway,
Lieutenant Monkberg says. He looks so pathetic that Shafto considers offering him some morphine, which induces a mild nausea of its own but holds back the greater nausea of seasickness. Then he comes to his senses, remembers that Lieutenant Monkberg is an officer whose duty it is to send him off to die, and decides that he can just go fuck himself sideways.
Sir, what is the nature of our mission in Norway, sir?
Monkberg unloads a rattling belch.
Ram and run,
he says.
Sir, ram what, sir?
Norway.
Sir, run where, sir?
Sweden.
Shafto likes the sound of this. The perilous sea voyage through U-boat-infested waters, the collision with Norway, the desperate run across frozen Nazi-occupied territory, all seem trivial compared with the shining goal of dipping into the world's largest and purest reservoir of authentic Swedish poontang.
Shafto, wake up!
Sir, yes, sir!
You have noticed the way we are dressed?
Monkberg refers to the fact that they have discarded their dog tags and are all wearing civilian or merchant marine clothing.
Sir, yes, sir!
We don't want the Huns or anyone else to know what we really are.
Sir, yes, sir!
Now, you might ask yourself, if we're supposed to look like civilians, then why the hell are we carrying Tommy guns, grenades, demolition charges, etc.?
Sir, that was going to be my next question, sir!
Well, we have a cover story all worked out for that,
Come with me.
Monkberg looks enthusiastic all of a sudden. He clambers to his feet and leads Shafto down various passageways and stairs to the freighter's cargo hold.
You know those other ships?
Shafto looks blank.
Those other ships around us? We are in the middle of a convoy, you know.
Sir, yes, sir,
Shafto says, a little less certainly. None of the men has been above decks very much in the hours since they were delivered, via submarine, to this wallowing wreck. Even if they had gone up for a look around, they would have seen nothing but darkness and fog.
A Murmansk convoy, Monkberg continues. All of these ships are delivering weapons and supplies to the Soviet Union, see?
They have reached a cargo hold. Monkberg turns on an overhead light, revealing crates. Lots and lots and lots of crates.
Full of weapons, Monkberg says, including Tommy guns, grenades, demolition charges, etc. Get my drift?
Sir, no, sir, I do not get the lieutenant's drift.
Monkberg comes one step closer to him, unsettlingly close. He speaks now in a conspiratorial tone.
See, we're all just crew members on this merchant ship, making the run to Murmansk. It gets foggy. We get separated from our convoy. Then boom! We slam into fucking Norway. We are stuck on Nazi-held territory. We have to make a break for Sweden. But wait a second, we say to ourselves. What about all those Germans between us and the Swedish border? Well, we had better be armed to the teeth, as what? And who is in a better position to arm themselves to the teeth than the crew of this merchant ship that is jam-packed with armaments? So we run down into the cargo hold and hastily pry open a few crates and arm ourselves.
Shafto looks at the crates. None of them have been pried open.
Then, Monkberg continues, we abandon ship and head for Sweden.